teachers protesting in Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Arizona over the last few days. In Oklahoma, where budget cuts have forced some of the schools to operate on a four-day-a-week schedule, 30,000 teachers are striking for a second day today. In Kentucky, thousands flooded the Capitol yesterday over changes to their pension plans. They're back in class today. And in Arizona, teachers want a 20% pay hike and more state education spending. They haven't called a strike yet, but they're threatening to. Noah Carvelis is an elementary school music teacher in Tolleson, Arizona, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've been organizing with a group known as Arizona Educators United. What is that group and what do you want?
So it's a group of about 40,000 members. We have mainly educators in there, but we also have a lot of supporters and a lot of parents and community members. We're organizing for a number of things. As you mentioned, one of the biggest things is a 20% pay increase for educators. That puts us on, it won't quite get us to California's levels or Utah's levels or New Mexico's levels, but it at least makes us competitive. So we're looking at that. We're looking at closing some of the corporate tax holes that are going on here, increasing our per pupil funding, which is 48th in the nation. So we have a couple different main focuses, primarily funding, and that includes teacher pay and per pupil spending.
Okay, so the average teacher salary in Arizona is around $48,000 a year. That's compared to more than $79,000 here in California.
Mm-hmm.
You say you want a 20% increase, so that's around $10,000. Is that enough? Is that a salary you could live with, a $58,000 a year salary?
No, it's not. And when you look at the numbers that we're going off of, which are the Morrison Institute numbers here, that's kind of our guideline for most organizations looking at these things. Elementary school teachers here make $42,000 on average. I myself make far less than that. I took home $28,000 last year. So that 20% increase will get us about $8,000 to $9,000 for most of us. That still leaves us below essentially everybody in the nation, far, far behind California. We don't even essentially factor you guys in California in because you're like light years ahead of us in this. But
well, we're also light years ahead when it comes to costs, too. Housing costs are a lot higher here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And so we have a huge issue here with revenue. We're having more money go out for tax breaks and exemptions than we're bringing in revenue some years. Corporations right now are paying $600 million less in taxes than they did in 2007. So that's one of the biggest issues here. We're letting the corporations have the money that should be going to the public. That's one of the definite issues that we're up against here in Arizona.
So your governor there, Doug Ducey, who's a Republican, has flat out rejected this 20% increase.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right. Yeah.
Are you willing to compromise?
You know, we're not willing to compromise. We need anything right now because teachers, we're hemorrhaging teachers. We can't keep teachers in the classroom. Teachers can't keep food on the table. So we need anything, but we really need to get to 20% because we're, like I said, we're hemorrhaging teachers, and 20% at least gets us close to being competitive. And so we have to get that 10%. We're still last in the nation for elementary teacher pay. So even 10%, that still leaves us in 50th.
So describe what it's like for you just living on that salary. I mean, how do you live and what's the situation in the classroom in terms of supplies?
Oh, it's difficult. So for me personally, I mean, I had to move out of my apartment. I couldn't afford it anymore. And I went into that apartment as a first-year teacher knowing what my salary was, and it went up. The cost of living went up there. They raised my rent, and I had to move out. So, that's not an uncommon story. I was talking to a woman the other day. She has two master's degrees, about two decades of experience. She had to move back in with her parents. She had to take her daughter and go back in with her parents. I mean, this is a professional. She's been in this career for about two decades, has three degrees, and she had to move back in. So, it hits everybody really hard. We're all just kind of scraping by, essentially. And then in the classroom, it's the same thing. We don't have money in our salaries, and we don't have money in our classrooms. Our per pupil funding is 40th in the nation. So we're trying to make it work with anything we can. I have large class sizes here, as most people do, and sometimes I have 40, 50 kids if I have a what we call a split class where a teacher walked off or they're out for the day and we can't fill it. So then I have 40, 50 kids in here and, for example, seven working keyboards. It just doesn't work to have more students than you have chairs some days. It's a crisis. It's mm-hmm. honestly a crisis here.
Okay, so we've seen what happened in West Virginia, in Kentucky, in Oklahoma with these walkouts. Are you thinking Arizona teachers might be doing the same thing?
So we have to see answers. And And that means, you know, our livelihoods are on the line for this. Our students who we love and care about, their futures are on the line. So we're going to do anything. And all options are on the table. And that includes a walkout. That includes a strike. We don't want to do that, but we will. One of the things that's kind of been a motto out here, and we had a huge rally with several thousand educators, and they all had on a button that said, I don't want to strike, but I will. Because if that's what it takes, we have to do it.
And then I understand there's also a planned statewide walk-in for April 11th. What's a walk-in?
So a walk-in, we believe that we really need to build community support. And you saw West Virginia did this really successfully. They did walk-ins where they met up with parents before school hours. They talk about their struggles. You show the way you're advocating for the kids, why you're doing this, why you have to take these actions. And then you unite arm in arm with the parents and you walk through the halls of the school. And it's a beautiful, bold statement of solidarity. So we're going to be having those going on across the entire state here next week. And it's, for us, that's the essential piece, is to build that community support, because it's not just about teachers. It's about every single person who works in the school. It's about every single person who lives in this community. It's about every single person in this state, because that's what we're fighting for, is our state and the future of our kids. And so bringing the parents in, bringing the community members in, that's pivotal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what if the parents say, look, we don't want you to walk off the job. We want you to be in the classroom teaching our kids, and, you know, that's your job. Don't walk off the job because, you know, our kids need to be educated, and we don't have a place for them to go while you're striking.
Oh, I would tell them, you know, the bigger crisis here isn't if we don't have teachers in the classroom for 2 or 5 or, you know, even 9 days like West Virginia. The crisis is we can't keep teachers in here, period. I mean, we're losing teachers. These schools, the profession of public education and teaching will be erased here. And with it, every single student loses that. They lose that opportunity at their future, at their education. So that's the bigger crisis, not having teachers in the classroom for 2 days. I mean, of course, we don't want to do that. We want to be here teaching. But the biggest crisis is if we maintain the status quo. Nobody can have that on their conscience as an educator. You just can't.
So let's assume that you don't get what you want, or not assume, but that's a possibility that you might not get everything that you want. Are you considering, you're young, are you considering maybe a career change?
You know, for me, I love this job. I love my students. I love being in Arizona. I can't stay here and do this. So I'm probably, you know, able to afford maybe another year or two here. And I think I'd probably go somewhere else and pursue teaching in another state, which is really unfortunate, but it's just the reality. If I want to do anything other than live in a 700-foot duplex in a little neighborhood here that I'm sharing with my girlfriend, I can't. It's just the reality. If I want to have a career, if I want to have health insurance, if I want to have a home of my own, I can't teach in Arizona, and that's the reality we're up against. So it's unfortunate, but I don't think I could.
Noah Carvelis is an elementary school music teacher in Tolleson, Arizona. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, many of the teachers like Noah who are protesting in Arizona, Oklahoma, and Kentucky say they were galvanized by a similar movement in West Virginia. Last month, teachers there won a big pay hike after a 9-day strike. For more on what's going on in these 4 red states and whether this movement will spread, we're joined now by Madeline Will. She's a reporter for Education Week. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Okay, why now? You know, schools have been underfunded for decades. Teachers have not been paid a lot ever. They've been underpaid for a long time. So why now? Why these protests?
Right. So when West Virginia was successful, when their teachers got that pay increase, I think it really galvanized teachers across the country. They thought, wow, if that could happen in West Virginia, which, as you said, is a red state, that could happen here.
But
go ahead.
But what sparked the West Virginia protests?
They saw that they were getting their health insurance was going up. They were upset about that. They were upset about the fact that they weren't receiving a pay raise that they thought they needed. There's been years of education funding cuts there, and it just reached a boiling point.
And I guess the same thing in Oklahoma?
Yes. Yeah, Oklahoma teachers, before last week, they hadn't had a pay raise in 10 years.
And so what are they making in Oklahoma? And what is the situation there? I've heard that they're now on a 4-day school week.
So about 20% of school districts there are on a 4-day school week. The average teacher salary is about $45,000, which is much less than the national average. It's among the lowest paid in the country. But last week, the legislature did pass a $6,100 pay raise for teachers. But teachers there are saying that's not enough. We had asked for $10,000 over 3 years. We asked for $200 million in education funding. And we're going to walk out until we see a commitment to more in education funding.
And do they have the support of the parents?
They do. The community and the parents are very supportive. Parents have said, you know, we see that our students might not be getting everything. You know, they might not be getting new textbooks or bigger class sizes. That they want teachers to fight for this education funding.
And these protests are happening in right-to-work states where union organizing has been on the defensive. And so these teachers, I understand, they're not organizing through their unions per se, but through Facebook. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's really remarkable. The unions, for a lot of this, have been playing a support role. This has been really a grassroots movement. Teachers have been organizing on Facebook. There's one Facebook group in Oklahoma that has 70,000 members. The group NOAA, the Arizona teacher was mentioning just now, has 40,000 members. You're really seeing this being driven on social media.
Yeah, and so politically, how is that translating? Is this a Democrat versus Republican issue, or is it more nuanced than that?
Well, I think it's really. I think it is nuanced, but I think the Democrats are using this to their advantage. They're riding the coattails of this protest. At rallies in Oklahoma and Arizona, Democrats were walking around registering teachers to vote and passing around petitions. And so I think we're going to see a lot of Democrats kind of positioning themselves as pro-education candidates in the midterm elections.
Yeah, and these states are all Republican. They have Republican governors, Republican-dominated state legislatures. Have the teachers been politically active in the past?
In Oklahoma, we have seen teachers there run for office in the past because they have been fed up with you know, years of budget cuts. But I think this is a really fiery movement. So, yeah, we'll see what this means for the midterms.
And do you think that this will spill over into any other profession?
I'm not sure. I think people are watching the teachers. I know Oklahoma state employees have said that they would, you know, join the teachers on the first day of the walkout. So I think all eyes are on teachers right now.
Yeah. Okay. And all eyes are on Oklahoma, Kentucky, as we mentioned. Also, the teachers walked off the job yesterday. Arizona, they're considering it. Any other states?
Those are the three main states. There's been rumblings in other states. I saw the Dallas newspaper published an opinion essay asking if Texas teachers should be walking out next. But those three are the ones that are really the furthest along.
Right. Okay. And so you mentioned that the unions are playing a supportive role. I wonder if they were also caught by surprise by all of this political action.
Well, the Oklahoma union has said that they were on the trajectory for this statewide walkout for about a year, but I think that the teachers drove it maybe up a little bit faster than they would have wanted. The Oklahoma Union originally said, we're going to walk out on April 23rd, and teachers said, no, that's too late. We need it to be April 2nd. So I think teachers are making this happen on their timetable.
All right. Madeline Will is a reporter for Education Week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the incredible story of the rescue of a 13-year-old boy who fell into a sewer tunnel in Griffith Park. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Now, a local story of survival that is being called miraculous. And that's a pretty good description, I think. 13-year-old Jesse Hernandez was playing in Griffith Park on Easter Sunday. He was jumping on some boards, and they broke. He fell 25 feet into a network of sewage pipes. Rescuers searched for more than 12 hours as Jesse was washed down the system.
The tunnel started getting smaller, so I just stood up fast. There's this big circle thing, and I just went up. I just stood up there for the last 13 hours.
The last 13 hours. Wow. Laura Nelson covered this for the Los Angeles Times. She's on the line now. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, describe exactly what happened to him. He was standing in this pipe for 13 hours that was filled with water and raw sewage?
Ugh. Yes. So Jesse was in Griffith Park with his family on Easter Sunday, and the family was preparing to do an Easter egg hunt, but Jesse and some of his cousins had run off. And they went into this little area of Griffith Park that most people probably don't really know is there. It's across the street from the entrance to the Traveltown Rail Museum, and it's a city sanitation yard. And in the back of it, kind of just abutting the 134 freeway, is this little concrete building that Jesse and his friends went into, either by climbing a fence or climbing through a fence. It's not exactly clear. And they were jumping up and down on a pile of wooden boards inside this little concrete building. All of his friends and cousins stopped jumping. Jesse jumped one more time. The boards broke, and he fell 25 feet into the sewer pipes that were directly below.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the friends went back, ran back to get help.
They did. And then this was at about 4:30 on Sunday afternoon. So they immediately went back to their family. Their family called 911, and it launched this immense search effort that took more than 12 hours.
Uh-huh. Because initially he wasn't exactly where he fell, right?
Right. So, I mean, you know, the shaft that he fell through connects directly into the city's pipe system, and there was liquid flowing through those pipes that swept him along. So rescuers initially didn't know exactly where he might end up. There's a whole network of pipes in that area. Some of them lead towards the river. Some of them lead into other areas. So first they had to figure out, you know, where exactly he'd fallen and where that pipe could eventually take him. And they slowly narrowed the field down to a span of about 1.2 miles and started kind of honing in on how they could look for him inside that tunnel. But the contents of the tunnel are so toxic that, and they're flowing fast enough that they couldn't send anyone actually down into the pipes to look for him there.
So he could have been washed away.
You know, the pipes eventually get smaller and they branch off into, you know, tunnel sizes that are small enough that he probably wouldn't have been able to fit into them. So eventually he would have stopped somewhere.
Yeah.
But he made it about 3/4 of a mile, which is, you know, no small distance when you're being swept through this 4-foot pipe in pitch darkness in kind of disgusting, toxic water.
Oh my gosh, yeah, horrible.
Yeah.
So how, technologically speaking, how were they able to actually finally find him?
I think this is so amazing. They, the city's sanitation department has a private company that works for them that provides cameras that move through the sewer system, which is probably something that most people have never thought about. But usually they're used to, you know, check for damage and do regular maintenance, that kind of thing. These sanitation workers strapped two cameras and two sets of lights onto these little floating platforms that basically look like mini surfboards or maybe boogie boards. And they tethered them to sanitation trucks using long video cables. And they fed the cameras and the little floaties through the tunnel. And they were getting live video feeds back into the sanitation trucks, showing them what the camera was seeing inside that tunnel at that moment. So after about, the cameras went in between 9 and 10 on Sunday night, and about 4 a.m. on Monday morning, they saw like a long, smeary handprint along the side of the tunnel wall, which suggested that Jesse had been there, and they knew they were getting warmer. Then the rescue workers moved the camera. They reeled it out of the system. They drove to the next manhole cover, which is on the 134 freeway. They opened it up, intending to put the camera down into the pipes again, and instead they opened the hatch and they found Jesse staring back up at them, screaming for help.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's just an amazing story.
It is an amazing story. And so when they pulled him out, how was he?
Amazingly, he was not hurt badly, which is kind of, it's a miracle when you think about how fast he was swept through the tunnel, how long he stood there, and the you know, in the wet and the cold. He was obviously scared. He was shaken. He said that he had spent the last 12 hours praying and just hoping that someone would come and find him. But after they decontaminated him, they took him to the hospital, and he was released only a couple hours later. So he was not seriously hurt in any way.
But mentally traumatized.
I'm sure. Yeah.
And has the city ever mounted anything like this before, this kind of rescue?
One sanitation worker told me yesterday that he couldn't recall anyone having had this experience in his 32 years at the department. So if it's happened, it was a long time ago. But it's kind of, it was a scale of rescue. It was more than 100 people searching for him that the city doesn't normally undertake underground. They might do it in the mountains if there's a hiker in distress or if there's a lost child, an Amber Alert, something like that. But this is a really unusual set of circumstances.
And they have the equipment, as you mentioned, the cameras and the lights. Mm-hmm. And they have that at the ready. Is it for these, you know, for this kind of circumstance or for something
else?
Well,
usually the cameras are used for kind of more regular maintenance of the system. So they might be fed through a tunnel to make sure that everything is in working condition. But they were creative and used it for this different purpose. And it was, you know, it took a while. It took like 6.5 hours for them to find him that way. But it was, you know, it was obviously successful.
Yeah. Okay, so this little concrete house that they got into, these kids, Jesse and his friends, what's mm-hmm. going to happen to that thing? Is it going to be just boarded up with tons of security now?
The city says that they're conducting an investigation, and they're not sure exactly what's going to happen until they finish that. They're still saying they're not sure how exactly he found his way in. It isn't like readily available to the public. It's separated from Zoo Drive, that big road in Griffith Park, yeah. by the city's sanitation facility. And there's a big stack of concrete K-rails and other stuff that the sanitation department is storing on that lot. And then it's beyond that. So they had to get through several layers of roadblocks, if you will, before they found it. So it's not that the property was completely unsecured, but clearly it wasn't secured enough. So it's something that the city will be looking at. The property hasn't been used in more than 30 years, so they couldn't explain why it was still there. And I think that's something that they're going to be looking at as well.
Okay. Laura, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's Laura Nelson. She covers transportation for the Los Angeles Times. Women usually get the blame for being hormonal because of the changes in their monthly cycles, but they're not the only ones.
Men have hormone cycles too. They're every day.
The truth about hormones, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
We are two completely different people, and I think it would just be easier for both of us if we stopped fooling ourselves.
You know, I know this isn't you talking, it's your hormones, but I would just like to say, you hormones, you are a crazy hormones, not Allison, hormones.
A scene from the movie Knocked Up, one of the many, many instances in film and television where women's hormones are the ultimate fun sponge. We blame them for mood swings, emotional breakdowns, and general grumpiness. But according to the last decade of research from psychologists, hormones actually make women wiser. Hormonal behavior is a product of intelligent design molded from 500 million years of evolution to help us survive. They help us make smart choices. They help us shape our relationships, change our physical appearance, even help us avoid sexual assault. Marty Hazelton is a psychology professor at UCLA and author of the new book, Hormonal, and she's here now to explain some of this tantalizing research.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming in. Okay, so first, just playing off that clip that we just heard from that movie, how accurate is that hormones completely dictate our moods?
I think that that's a fallacy. So there are a couple of layers here. One is that, you know, that we're automatons driven by our hormones, that we're under strict hormonal control. I think that's not true. However, I do think we experience hormonal nudges. Another thing that I think is important is how we view hormonal nudges when we are thinking about them with respect to women versus when we are thinking about them with respect to men. And I think there's a sexual double standard there.
Yeah, because we like to think, oh, women have hormones and men don't.
Or that women go hormonal. I mean, would anybody say that a man has gone hormonal?
Never. I've never heard that.
And if they did, would it keep him out of the White House? Probably not, you know. So there's this baggage that comes along with saying that hormones have effects on women. And I just think that there's no reason that evolution would have designed our hormones to make us go nuts and lose our rational faculties, which is the stereotype.
But they do, as you say, nudge us and maybe mm-hmm. contribute to some mood swings. It may be in some people stronger than others.
Absolutely. But, you know, that doesn't mean that men don't also experience hormonal nudges. Men have hormone cycles too.
And what do those look like?
They're every day. They're every day.
So it's like PMS daily.
Well, you know, I don't know that they're not totally comparable because testosterone cycles do something different than our estrogen and progesterone cycles. Men's hormones peak early in the morning.
And is that because that's just a better time for men to have intercourse?
Well, testosterone has positive consequences. So it builds men's bodies, it builds muscle mass, it helps to maintain fertility. But it also has some negative consequences. It's related to aggression. It's perhaps related to not being the best dad that you could possibly be because you're out there competing and looking for other mates. It's, you know, strongly related to mating intentions and mating desires. So if it peaks early in the morning, you can do those things that build your body. And then it drops off precipitously within like the first half an hour, 65% downward drop. Oh. Of waking. So, you know, men have hormone cycles too.
Okay. So let's talk about that idea about women, their hormones, and why they might be attracted to a certain type of man when they are fertile.
Right.
And so you've coined this phrase, the sexy cad and the good dad.
Right.
And women are attracted to the sexy cad.
So some of our first findings was that women noticed other men more and flirted with other men more on fertile days of the cycle. And that was particularly true if they said to us, well, my partner, he's a really great guy, but he's not the most sexually attractive guy around. And they preferred more muscular men, or they evaluated different kinds of male behavior and they preferred more dominant male behavior on high versus low fertility phase.
And
of
is that because that would be associated with a greater chance of actually getting pregnant if they had sex?
It could be that it's just a vestigial mist of our ancestral past. Or it could be that it actually served a function for our ancestral human females, that it was associated with good genes. You need to have the good genetic foundation in order to behave in that way, where if you're going to be a more dominant male, you better be able to back that up, right? Because you're going to get beaten down. You've got to have something going
some
on
swimmers.
There. Yes.
But that kind of contradicts the other idea, being that don't women want mates that'll stick around to take care of their offspring?
Right.
The good dads.
And this is the really fascinating thing about the preferences changing across the cycle. What women tend to want as the default is the nice guy, the guy who's going to stick around, kind, caring, cares about me, will be a good father to offspring should she decide to have them. But then there's this thing that happens that kind of pops up in the middle of the cycle that, you know, could reflect her doing a little bit of mate shopping, considering some alternatives. That doesn't mean that at every cycle women go and cheat on their partners. Or that they ever do at all.
But people do marry the sexy cad.
They do. There just aren't that many of them.
Hoping to tame the sexy cad.
Well, yes, they'll either try to tame the sexy cad, or they might get lucky and get like sort of the equivalent of Paul Newman. Right? So, you know, he's
the best of both worlds.
The best of both worlds.
Do men know when women are at their most fertile? Because other animals, they will exhibit signs.
Right. Well, scent changes in body odor is one of the most robust findings. And we've done some of those studies. So we affixed gauze pads underneath women's underarms at high and low fertility. And then we froze them all in the freezer. And we had a bunch of men come in and smell them. And they rated the high fertility samples as more attractive.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
What about women's physical appearance? Does that change when they are most fertile?
That's a little less clear. There is some evidence that perhaps women's facial attractiveness changes. Hmm. Their soft tissues change in such a way that they become more attractive.
Does she behave differently?
Yes. We found that they dressed more provocatively. Yes. So they've showed more skin.
And do they behave differently? Like, will they take more risks during that period of time?
Or? So women, like many other animal species, tend to get out more. They have more steps on the pedometer. And if you look at rats and mice, they run in their wheels more too. And so I'm certainly not saying that humans are like, you know, I'm not saying that humans are rodents, but there's a parallel, and I think that it has to do with mate shopping. You know, so get out there and see what the potential options are.
So they're more likely to go out to see a concert or
yes, to go out to places, clubs and parties where they might meet men. That's the question that we asked them, and they're like, yes, more on fertile relative to less fertile days of the cycle. But I do think this is all happening under the radar of conscious awareness. I don't think women are aware of these changes in themselves until they become educated about them. And then I think, you know, they're like, wow, oh, no, I do notice this. And I also don't think that when men notice changes in their partner's attractiveness, for example, like maybe her scent attractiveness, I don't think that they're thinking, smells like she's ovulating.
They just are like mysteriously just more like, attracted to their mate.
Yeah.
And how does being on birth control, on the birth control pill or other forms of hormones, how does that affect all of this research?
Yeah. So usually the hormonal birth control will eradicate hormone cycling. And so whatever bump we might see mid-cycle on these fertile days of the cycle in attractiveness or in what kinds of qualities women are attracted to, we expect that to be flattened out. But the progesterone-only pill is, progesterone is related to extended sexuality, which is having sex outside of the fertile period. In humans and in other species, this is thought to relate to pair bonding, and that makes some intuitive sense, I think. But if you're on the progesterone-only pill, you might be particularly interested in your long-term mate. There's just one study on this so far, but it suggests that this is the case.
So not to simplify it too much, but we talked earlier about the sexy cat and the good dad.
Right.
If you are taking a progesterone-only pill, you'd be more interested in the good dad than the sexy cat, and the opposite if you had the mix.
That's right.
One of the interesting tidbits in your book is that women who are in their fertile stages, or stage of the month, I should say, are more cautious.
Mm-hmm.
They won't, like, walk down a dark alley.
Right.
And is that because they don't want any old guy to...
That's right. Yeah. It's to preserve the power of choice, you know, because they might be a little bit more attractive, appealing. They may be wearing more attractive clothing. And so it's sort of nature's way of helping to keep us safe on those really important days.
So the way the hormone cycle is commonly portrayed in women, it seems like it is a roller coaster.
Right.
There are the days before you get your period, PMS, mm-hmm, there are the days during the period, during your period, then there are the after, then there's the peak fertility. It just seems like a month of lots of swings. Is that accurate?
You know, I think, I definitely think that women experience PMS as a discrete phase where they're like, something, you know, a lot of women experience that. Something feels different. I'm feeling, you know, particularly sensitive or upset with my mate. But I, you know, the other changes I think are more subtle, and we only become aware of them once we become a little bit more educated about them. The last chapter of the book is called Hormonal Intelligence, and I advocate for women following their hormone cycles. And this is true, you know, just thinking about the life course, but also thinking about individual hormone cycles for women who are still in their fertile phases. And, you know, you can sort of ride the waves of your hormones if you know how they make you feel. You know, one of the things that I hope that the book will do is make a call for more research. I think that women have been understudied for a variety of reasons, including that they were excluded from a lot of studies because they were viewed as messy because of their hormone cycles. And that's true all the way down to looking at the rodents. You know, they're running in their wheels more. Oh, that's too messy. We can't have them, so we'll just study males as the default. But one of the things that we know is that even at the cellular level, males and females are different. And so I hope that one of the things that the book will do is show that that is a bias that is not okay, and that suggests that there's much, much more to learn about women.
The book is called Hormonal, The Hidden Intelligence of Hormones by Marty Hazelton. She's a psychology professor at UCLA. Thanks for coming in today.
Of course. My pleasure.
All right. Warren Olney is here now.
Hello.
Hello. Long time no see.
Well, it's been a week.
It has. It's been a whole week. So you have a podcast called To the Point.
We do.
And what's on it?
Well, it's a very interesting subject this week. It starts out with Donald Trump saying we have to get the North Koreans to rid the Korean Peninsula of nuclear weapons. And then we go back in history, and it turns out that it was the United States, not North Korea, that first introduced nuclear weapons into the peninsula. And it was because President Eisenhower at the time wanted to save money. And it was cheaper to put in tactical nuclear weapons, as they're called, which can be used on the battlefield, than it was to maintain troops. It turns out, however, according to a very interesting guy that we talked to at length, that these tactical nuclear weapons are really quite useless because, first of all, they had them in Europe as well as in Korea. They were finally taken away in the George H.W. Bush administration, largely because of Colin Powell, who said we need to get rid of these things in 1991, because particularly in Europe, if you use them, you contaminate the soil of your allies, one. Two, the wind might be blowing in the wrong direction, and your own people are contaminated by the fallout. And consequently, they are not effective. And yet, the Trump Nuclear Posture Review, as it's called, is considering the reintroduction of these weapons. So we'll talk a bit about that and hear how popular the view of criticizing this is with what President Eisenhower once called the military-industrial complex.
Aha, okay, at the height of the Cold War. Thank you very much, Warren Olney. And To the Point is a podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe. It's free. To the Point. Thank you. Coming up, why Elon Musk has taken his sleeping bag to the Tesla factory floor. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Elon Musk is back to sleeping at his Tesla factory. The reason, as he tweeted yesterday, car biz is hell. He was responding to reports of more delays for Tesla's new Model 3 electric car. That's the cheaper one that's supposed to compete with the Camrys and the Priuses. And the last time Elon Musk slept in a sleeping bag near the production line was before Tesla's last vehicle launch, which was the Model X. So is that a good sign? Matt DeBord is senior correspondent for Business Insider, and he's here to explain. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Madeline. How you doing?
Okay, so what do you make of this new sleeping arrangement? Is that important?
It is important because it shows that Elon is taking the wheel, so to speak. He did famously do this with Model X when they were having what he called production hell with that vehicle, and now he's made a shift in it was being reported yesterday as a shift in management. He got back to people on Twitter and said that's not the case. I'm just taking control of my first job here, which is to make sure that the Model 3, which is their, you know, critically important new vehicle, gets back on track. They've had a really difficult time ramping up production on the car.
Well, is there anything to the fact that he is maybe spreading himself a little thin, what with the rocket ship and the tunnels and all the other stuff, that he hasn't maybe been spending enough time focusing on the cars?
You know, you could certainly make that argument. I mean, if he has to go pitch, if the CEO of this company has to go, you know, literally sleep on the floor, and he did actually sleep on the, it's not like he has a cot in his office or something like that. I asked him about this. He is actually sleeping on the floor of the factory, by all accounts.
So it's not just a PR move.
No, it's not. I thought, you know, okay, he didn't really sleep on the floor, did he? I was up there visiting the factory earlier this year, and I said, did he really sleep on the floor? And I said, oh, yeah. No, he slept on the floor. He was sleeping up there on the floor. You know, so,
but what does he hope to accomplish with that? What is he going to do being right there?
It's an excellent question. You know, is he going to be able to save the Model 3, get it back on track, inspire the workers? It was somewhat successful with the Model X, which, you know, it had an equally troubled rollout, and he is, you know, he is a problem solver. He fancies himself a problem solver. Like, he can look at a situation and say, why are we doing it this way? Why don't we do it that way? Or maybe we can accelerate this. Maybe we can, you know, speed something up here. He has a talent for engineering, and he considers himself, and you get right down to it, a product architect and an engineer. So he actually kind of likes this stuff. Hmm. I mean, he was sleeping at his Nevada factory where they make batteries for all the vehicles, for the Model 3 at this point, and trying to solve problems there. And I mean, you know, apparently having some success with that. So on the one hand, it's sort of, you know, rally the troops. On the other hand, it's a signal to the market, to the customers and the people outside who are paying obsessive attention to Tesla that, you know, he's very serious about, you know, fixing the problems with this car.
Yeah. And Wall Street's not really liking this, the Tesla brand too much these days.
Well, you know, the stock was headed toward $400 a share, and the market cap passed that of Ford and Fiat Chrysler automobiles last year in a huge surge. And at one point, it was sort of neck and neck with General Motors. And obviously, Tesla makes far fewer cars than those guys, and it, you know, hasn't made any money ever. And in that same period of time, you know, GM had an IPO in 2010. Tesla had an IPO in 2010. Tesla's done nothing but lose money since then, and GM has made over $70 billion in profits. So, you know, the contrast is vivid, and yet Wall Street thinks that, you know, there's immense growth. The bulls, anyway, think there's immense growth ahead for Tesla, and that's why the, you know, the stock price has been so high. But it's been down a lot. I mean, it's trading up around, you know, 265 today, but that's far down from where it was last year. And you know, it's been in sort of a downward slide because people have gotten more and more skeptical about, you know, Tesla's ability to execute on the Model 3, which is the most important vehicle they're building right now, and also on the fact that Elon is seemingly stretched quite thin with the tunneling company, as you pointed out, and the rocket launches.
Yeah. Okay, well, what is the problem with the Model 3 production?
Well, you know, it's not 100% easy to tell, but what Tesla says is that they had an issue with the manufacturer of the batteries in Nevada. What they're trying to do is highly automate their manufacturing processes so they don't have to have as many people working in the factories, and they can do things a lot faster. So there were glitches in the battery production, which is ironic because they're supposed to be really good at making batteries. So even they were sort of surprised that this didn't work. And then they're trying to create a new assembly line at their factory in Fremont that is itself more highly automated. And some of the things are experimental there and haven't really worked out, I guess, the way they, you know, wanted them to. So they've been sort of, you know, building the plane while it's flying, in a manner of speaking. And, you know, this is nothing new. I mean, they had problems with the ramp up in production of the Model S, which is the sedan they've been selling for several years now. They had problems we've already discussed with the ramp up of the Model X. And, you know, true to form, they're having problems with the ramp up of the Model 3. And the thing is, you know, they're a new car company. They just don't really have the baked in, you know, decade after decade of experience that a big car maker that does business on a global scale, you know, has, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you were Ford, for example, and you had, as Tesla does, you know, something like 400,000 pre-orders for a car, you would figure out how to build those cars really, really fast and efficiently, and they would be of high quality, and you would get them out to the market so you could get the revenue. Tesla, on the other hand, launched the Model 3 back in July, and they've been saying, well, we're going to have this many, you know, cars coming off the assembly line every week by X date, and they missed that. You know, they fell short of their own projections for the first quarter. They just reported that, you know, recently, and they fell short by about 500 cars, you know, per week by the end of the week. They restated their ability to get to about 5,000 cars a week by the end of, you know, the next quarter, the second quarter, and obviously there's going to be tremendous skepticism around their ability to do that. So the bottom line is, you know, they're really great at making these sexy, interesting automobiles that run on electricity and kind of captivate people's imagination, but when he gets right down to it, the nuts and bolts aspect of the car making process is something that they're not that great at this point.
So those people, I guess it was nearly 500,000 people who put down their $1,000 deposits. What's going to happen? Are they going to have to get their money back, or are they going to get their car ever?
They have had some, you know, cancellations, which they chalk up to people. You know, what they're doing right now is they're selling a $44,000 version of the Model 3, and the base version of the car is $35,000. So they're not selling the cheapest version of the car. They're selling one that has, you know, a big battery for longer range and has better performance and more premium appointments. And that's the car you can buy right now if you put a deposit down of $1,000. If you don't want to buy that car, then they're not going to make it and sell it to you yet. So you have to wait. And if you don't want to wait, you might want to get your deposit back of $1,000.
And do you know how long you'd have to wait?
If you put a deposit down now, you're probably going to have to wait 12 to 18 months at a minimum. And, you know, I keep telling people if they want to buy a Model 3, you know, you've got to be prepared to wait 2 or 3 years while they get this thing sorted out with production. And you know, if you want for example, you want an all-wheel drive version of the car that's long range, they're not making that car right now. So you're just going to have to wait till they figure out, you know, when they're going to be able to bring it online. They're asking a lot of patience of investors, and they're asking a lot of patience from customers at this point. And so far, because the stock hasn't completely tanked, they're getting, you know, patience from investors, and they're getting patience from customers. But it's not going to last forever. You know, they've got to get this thing on track, you know, ideally within the next 6 to 12 months. Because if they don't do that, then, you know, there are going to be serious questions on Wall Street about their, you know, viability as a company. I mean, their bankruptcy risk is not insubstantial.
So that tweet, that April Fool's tweet, might prove prophetic.
That's right. You know, they have access to the capital markets, but they say they're not going to raise any more equity by issuing more shares this year. They have credit lines that they may wind up tapping. Elon in the past has sold, you know, shares and chunks of the company to big investors. Like he sold 5% of the company to a Chinese concern called Tencent last year. At one point or another, Toyota owns some of Tesla, and Daimler, you know, Mercedes-Benz has owned some of Tesla. They don't anymore. They sold off their stakes. So he has options as far as being able to raise money if they need money. I mean, he could call up, you know, one of his Silicon Valley buddies and say, I need a couple of $1 billion.
Yeah, can you cut me a check.
Keep Tesla going. But if you look at their balance sheet, it's you know, not a solid balance sheet. It's very heavily laden with debt right now. You know, they have a kind of interesting problem in that their debt is, you know, debt being traded is going down in value, and yet they have this high market cap. So, and it's not investment grade debt. It's, you know, junk bonds. So not all of it, but some of it. And you don't usually see that. You don't usually see a company that has a, you know, 40 plus billion dollar market cap that also has, you know, junk debt that's trading around. typically a company that's not doing as well would have to issue the junk debt to attract investors to, you know, put their money into the outfit. So there's all kinds of contradictions and strange things about Tesla. It's a very weird time if you're looking at the company right now, because it's definitely crunch time. They're right on the edge. And it's not surprising to me at all that Elon's decided to get the sleeping bag out and go back to sleep on the factory floor, because it's kind of, you know, it's kind of imperative that this gets sorted out.
Matt DeBord is senior correspondent for Business Insider. Thanks, Matt.
My pleasure, Madeline.
All right. That'll do it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.